I'm back. Public Works is requesting to award the bid for the traffic lights, street and pole lights maintenance and repairs in the amount of $100,000 for a one-year period from October 25, 25 to October 24, 26.
Thank you, Christie. When it says traffic lights, street and pole maintenance and repairs, what pole maintenance does DPW have control of?
So this bid encompasses the streetlights that the city maintains. It is the decorative lighting that the city maintains, the field lights, the school hazard lights, any traffic lights that we own, such as like Buttonwoods and Main or the one at Weathersfield. So it covers all of that.
And I know I, speaking for myself, I received recently a couple of calls from constituents where the traffic lights are just out. That's something that is handled through DPW?
Yes, okay. If we own them. There are traffic lights that we don't own. We actually own less traffic lights than people, like the red, yellow, green, those traffic lights. Yeah, it depends on the location.
Okay. So like the ornamental lights aren't necessarily the city's responsibility.
What do you mean by ornamental? So
there's neighborhoods that have underground lighting and they don't have like the telephone pole. So they have their own decorative pole with a light on it. That's not maintained by the city, right?
No, we do the decorative lights that are owned by the city, like the ones outside on the sidewalks. But
right.
No, nothing like that.
Okay. Any questions from members of the committee? Councilman Muto.
Hi. A couple of questions on the traffic lights and maintenance. So this is a maintenance contract. And are we committed to spending the whole $100,000 or is it a pay-as-you-go and we're tracking it and we're evaluating the success of the work that they do?
It is... We don't anticipate spending the entire $100,000. The majority of this this bid goes to the streetlight repairs that the city maintains now. That portion is $65,000. The balance of it would be anything that is related to the traffic lights, the decorative pole lights, the hazard beacons at the schools, things like that, and then any field lights that we have to fix. So that's where the bulk of it is. But we don't encumber everything. As we get complaints or we get notified that something's out, that's when, you know, obviously we fix it. And so, I mean, I think this year we've probably spent about, actually I can tell you how much we've spent. Lights. So no, we don't anticipate spending it, but in the event that we should need it and, it is available.
So let's just do round numbers. So you didn't spend $60,000 last year. When you're looking and assessing what needs to get done on the street lights, such as pedestrian safety, crossing, things of that nature, is when you're maintaining, do you consider upgrades or do you just maintain the technology?
I'm sorry, do we consider what?
Upgrades. To the technology that's there, for example?
No.
No.
We wouldn't upgrade anything unless it was completely unfixable. For example, the box at Main and Buttonwoods a few years ago, that whole thing had to be replaced, lights and all. So no, we maintain what we have unless, you know, it gets hit or, you know, something like that. And then we would obviously replace it. And if we replace it, it would be newer technology. Yep.
So Main and Buttonwoods is a light that is owned by the city and not a split?
Yes.
I thought Main was a state road. Okay, maybe not.
We tried to get rid of it, but they said no.
Okay. So that actually, so I did put a request in, just FYI, identifying, I was asking for a list of city-owned intersection lights, the ones that are state-owned in a mix. And I was wondering if you've seen that request.
I have not.
Okay.
But that doesn't mean, I mean, it could have gone to somebody else. I personally have not seen it.
All right. Thank you.
Christie, I think you said you spent $60,000 in this item last year?
No, we spent.
I just heard the number 60,000, so I'm not sure where that
65,000 is the line item in engineering for the streetlight maintenance.
Okay.
Maybe and that's what you heard.
Maybe. And you're looking for 100,000 now?
Correct.
Why?
So a lot of the streetlights that we own now were under warranty when they were replaced, and they're coming out of warranty. So we anticipate that being an increased cost to us this year. And, you know, if we have to have anything fixed at Ben Street, at Mickey Stevens, at Clegg Field, I know some of them are new, but those will also come out of warranty at some point. So we're just trying to plan ahead in the event something should happen, and we have the resources to have them fixed.
And this replacement of lights that are out for whatever reason, that is being done by our own in-house people?
Which, you mean the streetlights? That was all done by K Electric. I think that was done through the planning department. As far to my knowledge, we didn't have any involvement in as
How
far
about
as public
now,
works.
Though?
Now we maintain them.
That's
so that
yes. Yeah.
So if there's lights out or anything like that, okay. We maintain them now. It goes through public works.
Okay. All right, thank you. Any other questions from members of the committee? Any questions from members of the council? Any questions from members of the public? Do we have any questions from members of the public? Hearing none, we'll move on to item number 8, found on page 51, public safety equipment.
Good evening, Alan Gouveia, Assistant Chief from the Fire Department.
Good evening, Chief.
Good evening, again. The Fire Department is requesting a 612 alteration of contract for bid 2025-023, Public Safety Equipment, Fire Equipment Supplies and Services. This is the MPA Mass PSE-01 to add the following vendor, Green Mountain Communications out of Pembroke, New Hampshire, and increase the spending authority by an additional $85,000. With no change in the effective dates. This request, if approved, will increase the total award to $279,905.20. As part of the ongoing relocation of the Fire EMS Emergency Dispatch Center from Sandy Lane to Potawatomi Station 10, we have to do work on the towers and relocate antennas at Station 10 and do some upgrades to the tower at Sandy Lane. So that's the reason why we're adding Green Mountain Communications. Additionally, the Fire Department currently has a favorable relationship with each of the existing fire equipment vendors. We're confident they can continue to fill the needs of the department. Each vendor offers a significant discount on firefighting equipment from a variety of manufacturers. And we will continue to be diligent in receiving pricing from each of the vendors on the MPA to get the lowest possible price for the equipment we purchase. The effective dates of this bid are 4/2/2024 to 12/31/2026. The additional funds for this request will be expended from the following budget codes: 35-235 supplies firefighting for $45,000, 35-799 from the miscellaneous capital expenditures line item from this year's capital budget, $20,000, and 34-354 from Emergency Operations, EMA, for the final $20,000.
And Chief, your line item 35-235 in the amount of $45,000, how does that compare to last year's numbers?
Last year, we spent $49,796 out of that line item. We did reduce our budget this year, and also we anticipate having to buy a little bit less in fire equipment because we're not taking delivery of any new pumper trucks this year. So every year when we take delivery of a pumper truck, we have to buy, there's associated axes and Halligans and hose and appliances that we have to buy for it. We're not taking delivery of a pumper truck this year.
Okay.
So we do anticipate being able to work within the $45,000 limit.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions from members of the committee? Do we have any questions from members of the council? Are there any questions from members of the public? Do we have any questions from members of the public? Hearing none, we'll move on to item number nine, 2026-116. And that is found on page 56.
Public Works is requesting to purchase the carts, lids, and wheels for the household rubbish and recycling that we pick up. It's a one-time purchase in the amount of $64,940.45.
Christy, what did we pay for these carts when they were last purchased per unit?
I don't have that information with me, but I'm pretty sure that it was right around the same price. I want to say it might have been like 59 and change. So it might have gone up, you know, by a very small increment. This is for a full trailer load of the carts.
Okay. And how many carts do you have in inventory right now?
To my knowledge, I don't think we have any that are, we have some of the smaller ones, like the 35-gallon ones, but then we end up having, we have to give homes, two of those, and then we have to go out and swap them when the new ones come in. Plus, with all the new homes that are being built and occupied, we've had to distribute carts to them as well. So our inventory, if we have anything at all, is extremely low. And then we also need the repair parts, the wheels and the pins and the rods.
And the this lids. Amount that you're looking for today, how does that compare to the amount you asked for last year?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the first part of that question.
So this year you're looking for roughly $65,000 for purchasing carts and wheels, et cetera. What was the budget for that last year?
Last year, we had in that particular line item, we had a budgeted $50,000. In October of 24, we purchased $49,994 of materials. And then in April of 25, we had a smaller order of $14,361.75, which came out of the tipping fees line item.
Okay. Any questions from members of the committee? Any questions from members of the council? Do we have any questions from members of the public? Are there any questions from members of the public? Hearing none, we will move on to item number 10. That is found on page 59. And this will be the last item over 50,000. That is 2026-045 e-permitting.
Phil Carlucci, IT Director. This is a request under City Ordinance 56-6, exception to bid, to award the annual service and support contract for the OpenGov Cloud Services to OpenGov Inc. in the amount of $53,539.20. This is an approximately 25% increase from last year. However, it's including two new departments. Two areas that we'll be using, and each area is charged separate, minus the two additions. It's a modest couple percent increase. The pricing is based on state continued negotiations with this. It's also a state mandated for building and partial planning. We anticipate this year that we will be reimbursed for the building department's portion of this from the state, as we have been in the past. And we're also trying to get a portion of the planning department's mandated piece to be reimbursed by the state. This is coming, it runs from July 1st to June 30th. It's coming late, as it has every year, because they negotiate with the state. And for whatever reason, it takes them into July to negotiate for it. So we wrote it up as soon as we got the pricing on it for this year.
So you're certain of a reimbursement of roughly $11,600 for the building department?
For building, yes.
And it's right now, it's a question mark about $9,600 on the planning, whether or not you're going to get part of it or none of it.
Correct.
Okay. When do you expect to know on that?
Usually about January of next year, when we finally get the, between December and January of the reimbursement, we just have to discuss and break out mm-hmm. what it is the planning department's using it for.
Okay. Any questions from members of the committee? Any questions from members of the council? Any questions from members of the public? Do we have any questions from members of the public? Hearing none. Thank you, Director. We'll move on and ask. I will first ask the committee if there are any items that anyone would like to have. We'll start with Councilman Foley.
Just one. It is item number 28.
It's item 2026-126. That's item number 28, found on page 168. Any others from any members of the committee? Yes, Councilman Muto.
Hi, Chairman. Thank you. I'd like to pull out item 2026-116, annual maintenance time clock system.
Okay, and hold on. That'll be item number 19, found on page 114, correct?
Yep.
Okay.
And 2026-111, office tracker calendaring system.
That's item number 29, found on page 171.
Yes.
It was item number 2026-111, found on page 171. It's item 29 in our packet. You're welcome. Councilman Napa.
Thank you, Chairman. Just item number 12-2026-090, and that is found on pages 66 through 69.
Okay. No, I'm not. I'm going to be looking for item number 14, item number 2026-042, found on page 78. Okay, I'm also going to be looking at item 2026. It's item number 15, found on page 90. And that's all the committee has. Any members of the council have any items they want held out? Doesn't look that way. Any members of the public? Are there any items members of the public would like to have held aside that's under 50,000? Hearing none. Okay. The council president has asked for us to do a pause on the finance committee. I need a motion for a pause.
So moved.
We have a motion. We have a second.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Thank you. We will turn the meeting over to the council president.
just so everyone's aware, I'm waiting till 6:30 to convene the full council. Then we'll go through the usual formalities, general communications, executive communications. Then we have public comment. Then we have a public hearing. And then we'll have executive session. And then after that, we're back to committees. All right, if all right, so public. City Council convene at 6:30 p.m. If clerk could please call the roll.
Mr. Sinapi?
Here.
Mr. DeLuise? Mr. Foley?
Here.
Testing.
Yeah.
Mr. Lattimore.
Here.
Mr.
Udo.
Here.
Here. The Councilman DeLuise can lead us in the Pledge of Allegiance. First, we have general communications, which includes announcements of congratulations, condolences, or community events. Does anyone have anything for general communications? Councilman Lattiser?
Thank you, Mr. President. I would like to ask for a moment of silence for one of our very loyal and dedicated employees, Mr. Joe Blake, who has recently passed away.
All right, we'll take a moment of silence. Does anyone else have anything for general communications? Seeing none, we go to executive communications, for which there are none. Next, acceptance of minutes from the council meeting held on July 7th, 2025. Does anyone have any objection to the minutes as presented? Councilman Ricks?
I'll abstain on that.
All right, can someone move those for approval? Motion for approval by Councilman Lattiser, seconded by Councilman Muto. All in favor?
Aye.
All opposed? And one abstention from Councilman Ricks. Next, we have public comment under Rule 41. After general communications and prior to the consent calendar at the last regularly scheduled meeting of the City Council each month, there shall be a period of time not to exceed 30 minutes during which citizens may comment about Warwick City government issues to the subject to the following stipulations. The total period of time for public comment shall not exceed 30 minutes. Comments need to be brief in order to allow as many citizens as possible to participate. Each citizen signed up and present shall have not to exceed 5 minutes to speak, provided, however, that if there are more than six citizens are signed up and present, 30 minutes will be split evenly amongst speakers. Time shall not be transferable amongst speakers. The topics for comments shall be issues directly affecting city government. City Council members will not respond to questions during the public comment period. The public comment session will terminate at the expiration of the earlier of all speakers concluding their allotted time or 30 minutes. Waiver of this provision requires a unanimous vote of the City Council. Thank you. So it looks like we got roughly a little less than 4 minutes. We'll round up 4 minutes for each speaker. First up is, and I apologize if I butcher pronunciation, Danelle Dubai. Oh, I should ask, does anyone have any objection to rounding up the time to 4 minutes as opposed to 3 minutes and change? All right, seeing none, it'll be at least 4 minutes for each. Sorry, go ahead. Just state your name and then have at it.
My name's Danelle Dubai, and I live at 99 Midgley in Warwick. And good evening, Council President and members of the Council. Thank you for your time. My name's Danelle Dubai. I live at 99 Midgley. And this is the last remaining home on what was once a neighborhood street, serving several houses and the public beach in front. Midgley Ave is not a paper road. For over a century, it has been the path that's connected families, neighbors, and visitors to the shoreline. Today, my home is the last one on the road, a two-family residence, once the summer home of Olympic medalist John Herbert Higgins, memorialized at Scarborough Beach. But the path is no less vital today. It continues to serve as the most direct and reliable route for both residents and the public, and more importantly, for emergency access to both 99 Midgley and the public beach in front. I learned this firsthand when I had to call EMS for my young son. When Warwick Fire responded, they were obstructed because the path was blocked with boat stands, pallets, and other marina equipment. The ambulance truck even scraped its side against a boat anchor as they tried to get through. Thankfully, my son was okay, but I cannot stop to think about what might have happened if the emergency had been worse or even at the public beach in front. A delay could cost, or any delay could cost lives. This path has always been more than convenience. It is the safest and most advantageous access point for fire, EMS, and utility services. Arnold's Neck Drive, the so-called alternative route, is a steep hill to the coast. It is narrow, congested with parked cars, and not dependable in an emergency. Midgley Ave, by contrast, is flat, direct, and proven by decades of use. When seconds matter, this is the access point that ensures a timely response. Preserving this path also benefits the entire neighborhood in other ways too. Keeping Midgley Ave open reduces congestion on Arnold's Neck, particularly in the summer months when cars already line the streets. It supports resident parking and utility deliveries for 99 Midgley, while still honoring the historic shoreline path that generations of Warwick families have walked to the beach. And before I present what we're asking for, I'd like to ask any present, current, or former residents of Arnold's Neck to please stand if you're in support. Because what we're asking for tonight is simple. We'd like to memorialize Midgley Ave as a public or neighborhood right-of-way to guarantee that it remains open and unobstructed, to designate it as a fire lane,
you ensuring have 1 minute left, please.
Emergency vehicles always get through, and maintain resident parking and utility access, preventing added congestion on Arnold's Neck. It's not about creating something new, it's about protecting what's always existed, a path that served families, emergency responders, and shoreline for over a century. In the binders before you, you will see photographs and records that document this story. They show the cottages that once lined the shore, the vehicles that traveled Midgley Ave before the marina was built, and the continued access that neighbors have relied on ever since. With that, I'd like to introduce Paul and Richard Schaffner. They were the previous family who lived at my house at 99 Midgley. Their family was there from the 1930s to the 1990s, and they remember Midgley Ave, how it's always been, how it still is. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, we have Paul Schaffner.
Hi, I'm Paul Schaffner. This house at 99 Midgley Avenue was in our family for 60 years. It was bought by my grandfather in 1937 as a summer home, and it remained a summer home for three generations. I have a great memory of childhood there. Boating and swimming and just playing on the beach. In 1968, when my father died, my mother had a heating system installed and it became her permanent residence. When my mother died in 96, we sold the house to John Dickerson. We were always able to park on Midgley Avenue and we needed that access for delivery such as heating fuel and large items. Neighbors used the access on their neighborhood walk and to drive down there to park to go swimming. Eppanog Harbor Marina even had a stairway installed so people could easily enjoy access to the beach. That's when they had the big stone breakwater installed so people didn't have to crawl over rocks to get down there. There's a picture in the Eppanog Harbor Marina website showing a roadway to through 99 Midgley. So it shows sailboat mast in a rack on the right and boats and cradles left on the left of the roadway. It was a nice roadway, nice wide roadway, and it shows the courtesy and respect that Eppanog Harbor Marina had for its neighbors. They cared about Arnold's Neck and the people that lived there because they were part of it. I see no reason that this access has to be closed off. It's important to keep this open for EMS and access the beach and to the property at 99 Midgley. Let's be good neighbors and keep this access open.
Thank you. Next is Lori Messier. Is Lori Messier here? All right, we'll circle back at the end. Next is Richard Langseth.
Richard Langseth, Budlong Farm. I asked that the time be expended because there's somebody was missing. Okay, I'm going to start. The Buttonwood Beach Association petitioned the Warwick Town Council for streetlights in 1902. A deal was worked out with the electric company and lights were provided. Then on November 22nd, 1909, the Columbia Land Company, the developer of the Seaview plat, now called Highland Beach, requested street lightings for that plat. It borders the Rocky Point Park to the south. The Providence Journal reported a request from the Columbia Land Company and resident owners of the Seaview plat near Rocky Point Station asked for five lights to be installed. The request was received and placed in the file. There is no money available for such purpose. Another item dealt with by the town council on that day was an additional petition from the Buttonwood Beach Association. The Providence Journal reports that Councilman Holden explained about the streetlights. The petitioners, that is the Buttonwood Beach Association, had agreed to pay any expense for the streetlights in Buttonwoods. I was very excited to have made that find that the Buttonwood Beach Association made promises to pay the city for street lighting 120 years ago. The problem is that the city of Warwick has been paying over $30,000 per year for these streetlights to the Narragansett Electric Company for many years. The Buttonwood Beach Association has skunked us. It does not pay its street lighting bills. Unless the Buttonwood Beach Association takes down its ridiculous, illegal, no trespassing signs, the city should pull the plug on the provision for free street lighting, free trash pickup, free waterline improvements, and free emergency management grants to the residents of, in quotes, private Buttonwoods. Watch out. The people of Warwick deserve better. We deserve access to the shore at Buttonwoods, free from the Beach Association's, in quotes, I know a guy, freeloading, and illegal no trespassing street signs. In addition, the water department is planning on a $2 million expense to fix the water line between Buttonwoods Beach and Oakland Beach. $2 million that the city is going to pay to fix the water line, yet the no trespassing signs stay up at Buttonwoods Beach. This is going before the CRMC in a couple of weeks. I don't know what's going to happen, but we need to deal with this situation. The Harbor Management Commission has asked the mayor to do a city solicitor opinion on whether Buttonwoods Avenue is public or private. As far as I can tell, he's pocketed that request. The Harbor Management Commission is going to meet in September, and they're going to ask, where's our opinion? What are we doing here? We're spending thousands and thousands of dollars to support an organization that calls itself private, when clearly it's been public since colonial days. I come back every month. I come back and ask, and you know what happens? Nothing. Mr. Muto has been offered some help. That's good. But the administration must step in. It's not just the city council, it's the administration. We have almost 80,000 people in Warwick, many new people coming from the Boston area that they expect to go to the beach. One more minute? I can't hear you. Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Langseth. Next, we have Rob Cody.
So as promised, I'm here to give you some data on the fire department sick time obtained from public records. These sick days and numbers per APRA do not include time out due to on the job injury or long-term illness. The numbers are from the period of 2022 to 2024. This should give you an idea on what's driving overtime. Sick days per person are as follows. George Lucinian, 96 sick days. Kyle Boulay, 88.5357 sick days. That's an interesting number, how we break down the sick day to the tenth of a minute when the department doesn't use an electronic computerized method of badging their employees in and out. But let that go. We'll talk about that later. John Perry, 86 sick days. Jason Warnerman, 82.8928 sick days. Tracy Titus, 82 sick days. Kyle Sullivan, 79.6 sick days. Stephen Sambrone, 77.4 sick days. Has anyone on the council been sick for 75 days in 3 years? I mean, this may be cause to go check these buildings, because there may be something in the buildings that are causing such illness for people that are supposed to be the pinnacle of health and fitness. Notwithstanding, if they're this sick, I don't think they should be exposed to sensitive people being transported to hospitals or nursing homes. David Danella, 76.8 sick days. Aaron Russo, 73.3 sick days. Stephen Gutierrez, 73 sick days. Brian Martufi, 71.2 sick days. Brad Genite, 65.35 sick days. Kevin Rivett, 63.8572 sick days. Mike Rada, 63.4786 sick days in 3 years. Michael Colantonio, 62.8571. Steve Smith, 61. Anthony Petrarca, 61. Kyle Wagner, 60.4 sick days. I mean, this is unbelievable. No one is this sick, right? There's communities in Africa that suffer from Ebola, and the people aren't this sick. David Hankins, 57 sick days. Richard Derrick, 56. Now, you remember Richard Derrick? He's the guy that got busted taking the dog to the dog groomer in the ladder truck last year. I heard because of that, he's now suffering from separation anxiety and because he can't take the dog. So he's out sick 42 days last year. Matt Cavanaugh, 55.6 sick days. James McDermott, 55.5714 sick days. Matt Delbonis, 54.3. Jonathan Sir, 51.2001. Another interesting number. Anthony Del Pozo, 50.5 sick days. I thought these guys were healthy. Daniel Vail, 50 sick days. Jacob Gabrielson, 49 sick days. Thomas Pacheco, 48.
1 minute, Mr. Cody.
Robert Palumbo, 47.8571 sick days. Peter Walsh, 47.7143. Nicholas Myrtle, 47.7143. Those guys got a lot in common. David King, 47.5357. I hesitated tonight because of the time, because so you all know, I did background checks on all these people, and I have their businesses, right? From like Jason Waterman, who has his website where he teaches CPR and first aid and states very flexible classes, last-minute classes, and George Lucinian, who's a contractor, and I have his information from the state of Rhode Island. And then Kyle Boulay, who's a wedding photographer, with 88 sick days. God, I hope he doesn't get any of the brides sick. That would be terrible. But you wonder what's driving sick days, and you think this is realistic. You don't think there's a scam going on? Wait until the new bill goes through where there's no tax on overtime. Wait till you see what happens then.
Thank you. Next is Cindy Wilson.
Good evening, Cindy Wilson. So I didn't really understand a lot about overtime. I've always been self-employed. So I did a little research and found out that in the United States, we are allowed eight full-time days off for sickness. Companies are minimally required to give people 5 sick days. The average American takes between 2 and 3 sick days. The Warwick Fire Department has 17 paid holidays in addition to all the other things that they get. And it just seems excessive from somebody that has been self-employed her whole life and actually has never had a paid sick day. If I don't work, I don't get paid. So to continue with the firemen and their amount of time out, we have Christopher Zeno, who has 44 days, Timothy Barabalt, 43 days, Andrew Kazarian, 43 days, Michael Carvalho, 42 days. I'm going to round up. Christopher Sullivan, 42 days, Kenneth Marriott, 41 days, Adam Brule, 41 days, Thomas Gibbon, 41 days, Nicholas Ulrich, 40, Zachary Rice, 40, Timothy Prada, 39, Thomas Maiman, 39, Richard Cooney, 39, Nicholas DiGiulio, 38, Michael Molo, 38, David Angeli, 38. And it just is amazing that these people are all sick the same amount of days. I ran businesses and had people work for me, and I wouldn't have been able to stay open if I had to had these people out this much. We must have an overabundance of fire department personnel. David Angeli, 38 days. Christian Hall, 38. Alex Torres, 37. Dana Weathers, 37. Andrew Sisson, 37. Norman LeMay, Andrew Sutton, Randall Hoxie, all 36. Stephen Cahoon, 36. Timothy Bedard, 36. Nicholas Varis, Joseph Duchame, 36, respectively. Michael Cookson, 34. Todd Bertham, I'm not even going to try that one. Cody Bella Vance, Daniel DeRobio, and Matthew Wood, all 34. Robert Johnson.
You have 1 minute, Mrs. Wilson.
So I'm not even going to finish the list. I think we know where we're going with this. I think we really need to do something. I'm on a fixed income. I just got my tax bill and my insurance bill, and I'm in for a grand a month before I even open my door. That's hard to sustain on a fixed income, which is why I rent out a room in my house. I don't like it. I kind of clean toilets for a living. I don't like it. So I wish that we could try to rein in the fire department and not have such excessive sick days and sick leave. Thank you.
Next is Richard Schaffner. All right, and then next is Heather Buckley.
Hi, Heather Buckley, 511 Greenbush. Good evening. I'm here to address a matter that has been causing significant distress on Greenbush Road, one that directly affects our quality of life and the well-being of those who live and work in our neighborhood. Across the street from my house, a builder has been operating in a manner that violates Warwick's noise ordinance. Under Warwick's noise ordinances, section 40-13, the maximum allowable sound level for construction activities in residential areas is 60 decibels. This threshold is not arbitrary. It is designed to protect the residents from the noise that can lead to health issues, disrupt daily activities, and cause stress and discomfort. However, the construction company in question has been willfully and knowingly generating noise levels that far exceed this limit for up to 7 hours daily. The sounds from their hydraulic breaker have been persistent, loud, and disruptive. This is not a minor inconvenience. This is an ongoing violation of our rights. The constant noise has made it difficult for people to sleep, work, and enjoy their homes and property. It is affecting the mental and physical health of our neighborhood, and it is simply unacceptable. Even though the decibel meter recorded levels that exceeded this legal limit, I was surprised that the police did not have any immediate authority to shut down this operation. Initially, I was blaming them for failing to enforce the ordinance, but after speaking to several officers, I realized that the problem lies with the ordinance enforcement provisions. The ordinance has no teeth, and the construction company knows this. They seem to operate without consequence. Why is this noise ordinance on the books if law enforcement cannot immediately enforce it? The process is too slow and ineffective. We cannot ignore that this company continues to operate unlawfully. I do not understand, when we have documented evidence that proves the violation, why the police are not able to walk over to the machine operator who is breaking the law and tell them to shut it down immediately. Does anyone really think a $50 fine for the first and second violation to the landowner, mailed to the landowner, is effectively solving this issue? That simply is a joke. He will just accrue the fines, pay them or not, and continue breaking the law day after day while we continue to suffer. The failure of Warwick to address this issue, or the inability of the police to enforce the law, not only undermines the effectiveness of our local ordinances, but it also sends a message that businesses can simply disregard the well-being of residents. I did walk over to them as soon as the breaker started its assault about 3 weeks ago, and I told them they were violating the ordinance. They laughed at me and they said, "Go ahead, call the police. They're not going to do a thing." I asked them how long they were going to be using this machine, and they said, "We're going to be here every day, all day, for years." So what can we do about this? First, the police must be able to take meaningful action to ensure that the builder complies with the law. Yes, they have a permit to clear, but the permit does not give them the right to break the noise ordinance. I went to the permit office and I pulled it, and I had an employee just check to make sure that was true. We are not asking for an unreasonable demand. We are simply asking for a peaceful and quiet environment, something that we are all entitled to. And let me just end this with what I hear every day for 7 hours. Sorry. It's annoying. I know. Trust me. 7 hours. 7 hours of that.
Is Lori Messier back? And then last shot, Richard Schaffner. All right. That concludes public comment. So we'll move on to the public hearing. PCR 86-25, a resolution. Unfortunately, no, ma'am. You had to have signed up on our list. I apologize. Next up, we have public hearing for PCR 86-25, a resolution authorizing the mayor to enter into a tax stabilization agreement with Renaissance Development Corp for residential purposes, including affordable housing at 1880 Post Road, Assessor's Plat 322, Lot 336. This is sponsored by Councilman Napper on behalf of Mayor Bacozzi, its Finance Committee, Councilman Lattiser.
We had moved that to the floor. For a recommendation for a public hearing.
All right. So we have a motion to open for public hearing.
Motion to open the public hearing.
Made by Councilman Lattiser, seconded by Councilman Mito. All in favor?
Aye.
All opposed? Any abstentions? All right, seeing none, we can open the public hearing. So we'll start with petitioner, and then hear from the city, and then we'll have lined up those in support, those against, and we'll make sure to hear from the council as well. So first, petitioner.
Good evening, Mr. President, honorable members of the Warwick City Council. For the record, Attorney K. Joseph Shikachi, representing the petitioner this evening. I have with me tonight some renderings I'd like to give to the council, and I'll be happy to go through a presentation, answer any questions. I have the owner of Renaissance Development, and I have the engineer. Mr. President, honorable members of council, what I'm presenting you is a elevation of site plans of what the proposed apartment building would look like. This is a request for the city to enter into a tax treaty, very short track treaty of 5 years, where the developer will use private financing and construct 179 apartments on Post Road, as we do quite often in Rhode Island, identify it, but what it used to be, the old Valley Steakhouse, a parcel of land. It's been vacant for some 30 some odd years. My client would like to develop it. We have had numerous discussions with the city. This was negotiated in good faith, subject to this honorable council's approval of a 5-year tax treaty. As you know, this area is surrounded by airport land, station district land, and that falls within the zone that automatically allows a 10-year tax treaty. We are not asking for a 10-year tax treaty. We're asking for a 5-year tax treaty. The reason for this, in exchange for this, we have agreed to make a certain component of this property affordable regarding median income. It is all spelled out in the ordinance that is before you, actually the resolution that is before you. We think this is a good use of the property. The property has been undeveloped, as I said, for 30 years. The moment that this parcel was petition was filed and became public, there was an article in the Warwick Beacon, and my client received, after numerous years of on and off negotiation, a formal notice to purchase the property, an offer to purchase from the Airport Corporation. So my client has rejected that offer. My client would like to develop the parcel privately, meet the needs of the city for market rate housing, as well as affordable housing. It would be a 15-year restriction for affordable housing components part of this property. It'll be a mixed use so that some of the property would look exactly the affordable, exactly like the market rate housing. This would abut the old Sheraton Hotel, which is also a residential use, apartments, and the Airport Corporation itself. The Bertucci's Pizza, which is closed, the Airport Garage, the Airport Corporation. That pretty much sums it up. I know that the solicitor has reviewed this. We sent a draft over. I know the mayor's office has reviewed it, and the tax assessor's office has reviewed it. I'll be happy, to the best of my ability, answer any questions. I point out, as a matter of information, the project, but I want to be very clear to this council that this project that is being proposed tonight meets or exceeds every single zoning ordinance.
I apologize for the interruption. For those wishing to converse, please leave the council chambers. Again, for those wishing to converse elsewise, please leave the council chambers. The acoustics in this room are awful, so we can fortunately can hear everything while at the same time somehow unable to hear anything as far as the presenter. It's not your fault. Again, bad acoustics. Sorry, continue.
Thank you. So what I wanted just to reiterate that last point, the project you see being proposed today does not request nor need any zoning relief or approval. It is properly zoned for this. It meets all the setback requirements. It meets the height requirements. It meets the landscaping requirements. We're not asking for any zoning relief. This is a multi-million dollar project. To be quite frank with you, that is a very economically challenged project, and that's hence the request of the tax treaty, the short-term tax treaty for 5 years. The cost of building new construction has gone through the roof. We have supply chain issues, but more importantly and most recently, because of the federal tariffs, the cost of lumber has skyrocketed. Most of the lumber that we purchase here in Rhode Island that we use for construction comes from Canada. We are looking at alternative materials, even more expensive. Some of them are built or constructed, or raw materials are coming from foreign countries. The tariffs have had a direct impact on the cost of this. It is skyrocketed. Every week, my client goes to the market to try to price it so that we can hopefully get to a point where we're break even and construction can stop. I'll be happy to answer any questions. I have Janice Matthews from Renaissance Development here as well, and I have a representative from Dupreet Engineer if you have any questions regarding the building, the structure, but it meets all of the parking requirements. We're not asking for any relief. That concludes my presentation. I will defer to any questions you have, Mr. President.
Does the city have anything to add prior to the next round of people? We'll get there.
She can't hear.
For those speaking, make sure you're speaking to the mic for the sake of the stenographer, please.
Frank Picozzi, Mayor of Warwick. Mr. President, I had noticed that Councilman Ricks had a question for Mr. Shikachi. Did you want to allow him to ask his question first?
We just want to make sure we get the presenters out of the way, including your own. Then that way, if people have more questions, they can tee them up.
Okay, so you want to get rid of me quickly. I get it.
Only if you want.
A little bit of history on this. Over 4.5 years ago, this is the former Valley Steakhouse. It's been vacant after it was a parking lot for years. I went to see Janet Matthews from Janco Four and a half years ago with Bruce Kaiser, the economic development director. At the time, we were trying to get the former hotel there. They didn't have enough parking for what they wanted to build, so we were going to ask Janco if they would consider selling part or all of the land to them. And she rejected that out of hand. She said she doesn't sell real estate, and she had no desire to develop. So I tried to keep in touch with her, and a couple of years ago, she called me up and she wanted another meeting. One thing she had told me that was very disturbing was that the Airport Corporation was trying to purchase the land. That scares me because that'd be another parcel of property, real estate in Warwick we'd have no control over. We'd come off the tax rolls forever. So she told me she was interested in developing it, the family was, and she'd asked my input into what they should put there, and I immediately said housing. We didn't need any more retail. They went to Dupreet Engineering, they came up with a concept, and she came to me. Initially, they asked me if we would extend the intermodal zone to that area, but I wasn't in favor of that because it would involve too many things. I'd prefer to keep it in the boundary. So working with Mr. Shikachi and Janet Matthews, we came up with this tax treaty. We've been over it. It's very fair. It's good for both them and the city. It's very short term. It's not like what's in the intermodal zone. So I think this is win-win for Warwick, and that's why we presented it tonight. Neil Dupree is here if you have any questions of him after I do.